From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! We go to Laramie, Wyoming, for opening arguments in the case of one of the men charged in the Matthew Shepard murder trial. Also, Ronnie Duggar joins us from the Alliance for Democracy. He'll be among activists who will be committing civil disobedience in Washington to protest the Senate's killing of campaign finance reform. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations formally took control of East Timor today, and leaders of the new transition team acknowledge they face enormous challenges in rebuilding the ravaged territory. Hundreds of thousands of East Timorese are still displaced. Building materials are in short supply as the rainy season sets in, and virtually all the territory's institutions, schools, courts, police, will have to be started almost from scratch. No one even knows what kind of currency the new nation-to-be will use. Meanwhile, the new Indonesian president, Abdurrahman Wahid, today announced his new cabinet. Despite his pledge to break from the corrupt and autocratic past, Wahid appointed four former members of cabinets that served under his predecessors, Suharto and Habibie. The four include General Wiranto, Habibie's former military commander and defense minister, who was named to the lesser but still influential post of political and security affairs minister. Also today, Wahid announced that East Timorese independence leader Xanana Gusmao will visit Jakarta soon, although he did not specify when. "I will meet him at the airport," the Indonesian president said. "This is important for East Timor's people to know," he said, "that we respect the international community." Late Thursday night, Xanana Gusmao was flown in secret to the capital of Dili, East Timor, by international peacekeepers who said he continues to be threatened by Indonesian-backed militias. José Alexander Gusmao, his formal name, gave a speech exhorting his weeping countrymen to show the world their strength. He said, "We knew we would suffer, but we are still here." He added, "We must put in the past the evil they have done to us. Tomorrow is ours." This news from South Africa. New evidence has been presented to South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission showing high-level apartheid-era government involvement in the killing of an apartheid activist. George Bizos, representing the families of the activists Matthew Ganaway and three other activists killed in 1985, known as the Craddock Four, submitted to a Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearing what he said were minutes from a March 1984 meeting of the State Security Council headed by then-President P.W. Botha. In the minutes, the, quote, removal of Ganaway, an anti-apartheid activist in Port Elizabeth, was called for. Seven former policemen, including Colonel Eugene de Kock, who headed a government death squad and is in prison for murder, have applied for amnesty for the killings, which they said were carried out to quell unrest. Months ago, the commission concluded hearings into the killings and has been deliberating on amnesty for the seven men. But Attorney Bizos said at the session yesterday the hearing should be reopened in light of the new evidence. The chair of the hearing said a decision on Bizos' request will be reached soon. If the hearings are reopened, members of the State Security Council, including Botha, cabinet members, and senior security force members may be summoned before the commission. The ruling parties of Yugoslavia's two republics, Serbia and Montenegro, opened talks today on proposals to reorganize Yugoslavia, possibly leading to the final disintegration of the country. Pro-Western Montenegro, Serbia's smaller partner in Yugoslavia, is demanding more independence from President Slobodan Milosevic's regime, which is suffering under international political and economic isolation. Montenegro's ruling Democratic Party of Socialists has said it will organize an independence referendum if the talks fail. But Milosevic's neo-communist and ultra-nationalist coalition partners have warned of a civil war if Montenegro tries to secede from the federation. A quiet end to chain gangs in Alabama. prison officials say they have closed down the last detail of shackled prisoners because they need the guards to work inside the prisons. The chain gangs featured groups of inmates shackled in leg irons, picking up litter and cutting underbrush along highways. The gangs were revived in Alabama 4 years ago, partly in an attempt to show how miserable prison life could be. The revival of chain gangs in Alabama in 1995 led Florida, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Iowa, as well as sheriffs in several jurisdictions, to adopt forms of the leg-ironed work crews. And this news from Brazil. Riot troops have regained control of an overcrowded juvenile detention center in Sao Paulo, ending a bloody 19-hour rebellion that left at least 4 people dead. All 16 guards that had been taken hostage were released. An official report said 300 youths escaped from the Imigrantes Detention Center for Juvenile Offenders. And in New York, the leader of Austria's far-right Freedom Party will be allowed to run in the New York City Marathon despite protests by community leaders. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Attorneys in the last of 3 murder trials and the dragging death of an African-American man will try to further reduce the jury pool today. Yesterday, about 170 potential jurors packed the courtroom in Jasper, Texas, as jury selection in the trial of Sean Allen Berry began. Almost 40 of those were excused immediately for medical reasons. Defense attorneys say their client is not a racist and wouldn't commit a hate crime. It was Berry's pickup truck and logging chain that were used to drag James Byrd Jr. to his death in 1998. 2 white supremacists have already been convicted in the murder and are on death row. Meanwhile, opening arguments began yesterday in Laramie, Wyoming, in the murder trial of a man accused of killing Matthew Shepard, a gay college student. Jurors saw photographs of Shepard's bloody face as prosecutors began presenting their case against Aaron McKinney, accused of beating the student to death in a drunken, drug-induced rage. They also saw pictures of the ponderosa pine fence where Shepard was left to die, his hands tied behind his back and the pool of blood caused by more than a dozen blows as he fought his attackers. Defense attorneys countered that McKinney, who faces the death penalty, didn't intend to kill Shepard when he and a friend accompanied Shepard from a Laramie bar after he asked McKinney for a ride home. The 21-year-old University of Wyoming freshman was driven to a remote area, pistol-whipped, and left overnight in near-freezing temperatures. The trial of the other man accused of the slaying that shocked the nation, Russell Henderson, ended in April, just before a jury was seated. Henderson pleaded guilty to felony murder and kidnapping and was sentenced to life in prison. The plea allowed Henderson to avoid the death penalty. In addition to the 2 men charged in the case, the slaying of Shepard has put on trial the small college town of Laramie, as well as the state of Wyoming, where attempts to pass anti-hate crimes laws have been unsuccessful. The vicious nature of the attack horrified the nation and reinvigorated the national debate on hate crimes. We go right now to Laramie, Wyoming, where Jeffrey Montgomery is standing by. He's executive director of the Triangle Foundation and a spokesperson for the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs. He's also followed the trial of Russell Henderson and is now covering the trial of Aaron McKinney. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeffrey Montgomery.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us again. We spoke to you last week when jury selection began, but now the jury is seated and opening arguments were made. Can you talk about the scene in the courtroom yesterday?
Well, yes. This trial has certainly moved along to this point, at least, much faster than anyone had anticipated. You know, initially there were 2 weeks set up to go through jury selection, and it was completed within the first week. And then the final jury was seated yesterday morning, and the opening statements were given yesterday afternoon, and we got through the first 3 witnesses. So the judge here is very interested in moving this along quickly, and we're looking at longer days, but perhaps a shorter time span.
So talk about the opening arguments of the prosecution and defense yesterday.
Well, I must say it was a riveting and a really an astounding afternoon. The prosecutor laid out the state's case in very clearly, very concisely. The reviewed the facts in this case, reviewed what the investigation had resulted. It was a very straightforward presentation of the state's case. The most stunning thing was the defense opening, however. It was actually presented not by the leader of the defense team, Deion Custis, but it was presented by Jason Tangeman, who is a Laramie attorney. And it was a stunning thing, as I said. Many of us who've been watching this case and who have watched dozens and dozens of homicides where gay men were the victims had been predicting that the defense would be eventually forced to resort to a so-called gay panic defense. And yesterday, we were proven right in the most blatant way. Mr. Tangeman wasted no time in making it very clear that not only was this going to be a gay panic defense, but that Matthew Shepard was going to be put on trial, and that he, the victim, is now being implicated in his own death.
Explain gay panic.
Basically, the idea behind this is to convey to a jury that the defendant was so outraged at being perhaps attracted by the gay victim, and the gay victim may have suggested or attempted, made a pass at him, as they say, and that he goes into a rage over this offense and humiliation and kills the person. It's a defense that we've seen historically be very successful in getting acquittals for defendants. And however, in the last 6 or so years, it has not really been very effective at getting acquittals, but it remains the most effective way to convince a jury to mitigate the responsibility of the defendant and come across with reduced verdicts from, in this case, capital murder.
Can you talk about the three witnesses following the opening arguments who testified yesterday for the prosecution?
Well, yes. The first was the young man who actually discovered Matthew Shepard, the first person to see him after he had been left tied to the fence. He was a bike rider and was riding past him and noticed that he'd been tied there. And he alerted the homeowner of the nearest home, and that gentleman not only called 911, but he also, with the biker, went back to try to see if they could do anything for Matthew Shepard. And that homeowner was the second witness. And the third witness was the first police officer on the scene responding to that 911 call, who did what she could to attend to Matthew Shepard before the EMS, the actual EMS crew arrived on the scene. So they were the first three people to encounter and try to assist Matthew Shepard on the morning after he had, or the evening after he had been left there on the fence. And that's when they brought in the very graphic pictures of Matthew Shepard at the hospital after he'd been somewhat stabilized. But they were very clear pictures of the extent of the facial and head wounds that he had suffered in these 12 to 15 very direct blows to the head.
We're talking to Jeffrey Montgomery, and he is the director of the Triangle Foundation, which is actually based in Detroit, but is in Laramie, Wyoming now, following the trial of Aaron McKinney, charged in the slaying of Matthew Shepard. Can you talk about the issue, Jeffrey Montgomery, of Wyoming, and it's not alone in this, reacting very vehemently against what happened to Matthew Shepard, you know, the state, a lot of officials as well, and yet failing to pass anti-hate crimes legislation? This very much ties to what's happening in Texas right now, as we see the jury selection taking place in the third man charged in the slaying of James Byrd, and anti-hate crimes legislation there.
Well, certainly, there, it's very important to point out that this case is certainly and definitely not a case about Laramie, Wyoming. This is a very quiet town. It's a very pleasant town, and it's a very welcoming town. This is supposed to be the liberal center of Wyoming. The University of Wyoming, of course, is located here, and it's a very, very... It's a very, very good community, and the point is, like Jasper, Texas, just as Jasper, Texas, should not be defined by that incident in the Byrd case. The point is that these kinds of crimes and these kinds of violent acts and homicides happen everywhere in the country, and they happen in places like Jasper, like Laramie, as well as larger urban centers. And I think that then to look at the broader issue of why, in the wake of this incident during the past year, Wyoming and Texas have failed to pass that kind of legislation, hate crime legislation, really goes to more of the issue there is the total disconnect between political leaders who operate on their own agendas, and the people of the states where these things are going on. I don't think there's any question that the people of Wyoming and the people of Texas, as well as the people of Michigan, for that matter, where we cannot pass hate crime laws, there's no question that the people in those states have the will and the desire and are in favor of having some sort of legislation dealing with this. But the political leadership, especially as it is being very much controlled and manipulated by very right-wing agendas, are not letting this happen. And they're not letting it happen, in my view, because these crimes talk about victimization of minority and marginalized people. And at this point, in the leadership in those states, as well as in the United States Congress, are not willing to make the stand that those things are that morally reprehensible.
What about Governor George Bush's role in the hate crimes legislation in Texas? It did die. He didn't speak out in favor of it. What was his position?
Actually, he was involved in killing the legislation in Texas. He has taken a stand, and he has made public his opinion that hate crimes are no different than others and that there's no such thing as hate crimes. In fact, he told that to a member of the Byrd family in the days leading up to the eventual vacating of the attempt to have hate crime laws in Texas. So Governor Bush is very much and very directly responsible for the fact that Texas could not pass hate crime legislation. And to suggest otherwise, if he were to suggest otherwise, he would be not speaking the truth about his role in that, because he indeed did, and by doing nothing to promote them, he further ended any possibility of that legislation passing in Texas.
I want to ask you one last question, and that's about the scene outside the courtroom. The protesters who've often positioned themselves around the Matthew Shepard case, these are the protesters of those who support well, who have decried the killing of Matthew Shepard. We're talking to Jeffrey Montgomery, who is head of the Triangle Foundation based in Detroit and is in Laramie, Wyoming right now to be there for the Matthew Shepard case. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we finish up with Jeffrey Montgomery of the Triangle Foundation in Detroit, who is now in Laramie, Wyoming, for the trial of one of the men accused of killing Matthew Shepard. What about the scene outside the courtroom?
Very much different this week than the than we've seen here either the opening week of jury selection or at the previous trials and other activities here. In fact, yesterday there was no presence of any side of this issue outside the courtroom. It was a very, very quiet, very normal day for downtown Laramie, except for the presence of about a dozen satellite trucks and media broadcasting outlet paraphernalia. You would not have known anything extraordinary was going on in the courtroom here. As you know, last week Fred Phelps was here with his anti-gay crusade.
Explain who Reverend Phelps is.
Well, Fred Phelps is a so-called minister of a so-called church in Kansas. He is the pastor of that church, and the church is made up of only his family members, but his career consists solely of traveling around the country with his family and with some of the most offensive signs anyone would ever see, and protesting AIDS funerals, gay people's funerals, protesting places where they have or are trying to have hate crime legislation. He's a miserable man, actually. And he was here last week, as were the band of about 20 angels that have become part of this story here in Laramie. These are residents of Laramie who show up to counter Fred Phelps' message of hate with their message of love and respect. And they dress up as these beautiful angels, and they sort of silently respond to the Phelps show, but none of them were present yesterday as this case actually got underway for the testimony phase. And I think part of that is that there's a very strong, if perhaps even unofficial, policy in Laramie by the people here whose lives have been very much altered by this whole episode to try and ignore these proceedings and try to keep life as normal as they can in Laramie and go on about their business and let justice take place inside the courthouse, but let their lives go on outside of it.
Well, Jeffrey Montgomery, I want to thank you for being with us. He is executive director of the Triangle Foundation and spokesperson for the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, two organizations that advocate for the gay, lesbian, and transgendered community. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, and happy to come back anytime.
Thanks. Speaking to us from Laramie, Wyoming, and we will continue to cover the Matthew Shepard murder trial. But we are moving now to Washington, D.C., where reform advocates are going to conduct civil disobedience and risk arrest outside the U.S. Capitol Rotunda today to protest the killing by Congress of the campaign finance reform bill, which the Senate filibustered last week. The action that is taking place today is sponsored by the Democracy Brigade, which was formed by members of reform organizations who believe that the existing private money system of campaign financing should be supplanted by one of complete public financing. The maneuvering last week by Congress showed the difficulty in getting campaign reform enacted by the very same people who benefit from the millions of dollars in soft money from interest groups, most of it coming from corporations and wealthy individuals. Proponents of finance reform say the current system corrupts the legislative process, while opponents, many of the Republicans, but also some Democrats, argue that the legislation is a violation of free speech. The killing of the bill provoked an outcry, prompting some heads of corporations to complain they're often shaken down by the politicians and political parties who make it clear they'll only have to earn for those who contribute to their campaigns. We're joined right now by some of those who will engage in protest today. Randy Keeler is with us, longtime war tax resister, co-founder of the Nuclear Weapons Freeze campaign, and also of the Working Group on Electoral Democracy. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Randy Keeler.
Hi, Amy. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Can you explain what exactly you're doing in Washington today?
Sure. If you don't mind, actually, let me correct two things you said a moment ago, which is we do have an ad hoc group called the Democracy Brigade, which will engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, not outside the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, but in fact in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. And we are actually not there to protest the killing by the Senate filibusterers of the McCain-Feingold bill. We are there to really change the subject, because the McCain-Feingold bill, while we wish it had passed and would make a worthy first step, was really just a very small reform in relation to what really needs to happen. And so what we are calling for is full, total public financing of all federal elections.
Can you explain, though, what the McCain-Feingold bill was that ultimately was killed?
What it was, Amy, was a ban on soft money. That means the unregulated big $100,000 up to millions of dollar contributions that go directly to the national political parties, and that the parties often spend on what they call issue ads, which are essentially disguised campaign ads that somehow escape regulation through a loophole in the law. And it's that kind of spending that corporations and wealthy individuals engage in, to the tune of millions and millions of dollars, that would have been banned by the McCain-Feingold bill. And that's all well and good, but the soft money is only a piece of the overall problem of privately financed elections. If you look at what's happening right now, for example, in this presidential primary situation, here you've got candidate Bush having raised $60 million, none of it's soft money. So that bill, had it passed, wouldn't have affected what's going on, that huge, obscene money chase that we're witnessing. So what we're saying is that essentially privately financed elections, as we know them, because we live in a society where the money is so unequally and unjustly distributed, can't possibly be made fair or democratic by tinkering with that privately financed system. You have to replace it. You have to have public funds paying for campaigns in the same way that we have public funds paying for voting booths, or voting registrars, or indeed for the salaries of the elected officials. This is a public process, elections are, and it's vital to our democratic system, and it must be paid for by the public if we want the system to be accountable to the public. So that's what we're saying in our demonstration, both at the rally that we'll be having on the Capitol steps at 12:15 and at the later civil disobedience action by the Democracy Brigade at 2 o'clock inside the rotunda.
Randy Keller, there was an interesting article under the big one last week when the campaign finance bill was scuttled in the Senate with a picture of Senators John McCain and Russell Feingold speaking with reporters after their measure failed to pass. And it said, as soft money flew in, a McCain crusade faded. And this was one case study of what happens when big private money is pouring into senators' pockets. It said, in February, with customer complaints about air travel at an all-time high, Senate Commerce Committee Chair John McCain took off on a passenger rights crusade. He filed an Airline Passenger Fairness Act to force airlines to clean up their acts, then held a dramatic hearing to spotlight tales of marooned, bumped, and otherwise mistreated travelers. The issue was so hot that several senators began sharing their own airline horror stories. In June, though, after the airline industry announced a voluntary plan to improve customer service and directed a hasty infusion of soft money donations to both political parties, the issue seemed to disappear. McCain replaced his bill with a much weaker version that simply encourages airlines to follow their own plans, and his committee overwhelmingly approved the substitute. We were stunned, recalled Aviation Consumer Action Project Director Paul Hudson. This wasn't just a sweetheart deal. It was a giveaway. Just one small example of what happens when soft money pours in around legislation.
Absolutely. In fact, there are much worse examples. As you know, Ronnie Duggar is here in the studio with us, the co-founder of the co-chair of the Alliance for Democracy, the founder of Alliance for Democracy. And Ronnie likes to talk about an even bigger scandal, corruption, boondoggle. Ronnie, do you want to talk about that Telecommunications Act?
Well, only after saying on behalf of Senator McCain, Amy, that he has told us that he has been as compromised as the others. So it's not as if, even though he denies having been compromised in the case you read, that if he had been compromised, he would have been a hypocrite. One of the things we're quoting from Senator McCain at the rally today at 12:15 at the Capitol, on the steps there, is McCain saying on June 30th, we are the defenders of an elaborate influence in which both parties conspire to stay in office by selling the country to the highest bidder. Now, that's both parties selling the country to the highest bidder. So McCain, not only that, but McCain specifically in that speech is not saying he's innocent. He said, as a matter of fact, he said recently that all of us have been corrupted by the process, and you can include me. So I think Senator McCain deserves the credit, this particular instance aside, for standing forth to the American people and saying, at great cost from the assassinative critics he had in the Senate floor the other day, that this system is rotten.
Ronnie Duggar, tell us one of your favorite examples of campaign money.
Okay. You remember in 1996, the Congress passed what was called the Telecommunications Act of 1996. In fact, what Congress gave us there was the privilege of the present billionaire corporation licensees of our television channels. They have been simply given for nothing, our, the public, six or more new channels that technical advances have made possible, new channels that belong to us, the people. Senator Dole says they're worth up to $70 billion of our money. And Congress consolidated control of the public space that we have to have for free speech and democracy. And Amy, I think if you compare it as to the Teapot Dome and previous thefts in the history of American scandals, it makes the Teapot Dome scandal look like kids stealing lifesavers. This is a $70 billion steal of public space for democracy that eventually is going to mean trillions of dollars in the private sector that belong to us. For an example.
You know, there's an interesting event that transpired over the last 24 hours since yesterday. President Clinton signed the $267 billion defense spending bill, but vetoed a bill to fund the Commerce, State, and Justice Departments. And he signed that bill just before heading to New York for a birthday party for his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And the way she celebrated that birthday was at a major fundraiser as she turned 52, raising about $1 million. Ronnie Duggar.
May I add this to what Randy was saying earlier about public financing, full public financing of all federal elections? What this is, after all, that happened a week ago, that Congress, for the fourth time in 4 years, really betrayed the public interest by refusing to reform the campaign finance system, even marginally. What we're trying to do is to raise the ante on the Congress. We're turning on the Congress and saying, hey, you guys won't fix a corrupt system. It's not enough. It wouldn't have been enough to fix soft money, and it wouldn't have been enough to fix independent committees. We need a new system. So we're trying to change the subject. And what pleases me especially about the rally today, which the Alliance for Democracy is sponsoring, is that Ellen Miller is speaking, and her organization, Public Campaign, is co-sponsoring. Chuck Collins is speaking, and his organization, the United for a Fair Economy, is co-sponsoring. The other speakers include U.S. PERG, Sojourners, Reverend Wallace is coming. There's a speaker from Greenpeace. There's a speaker from Democracy South. I'm afraid I'm leaving out some of the sponsors. Most important, perhaps, of the non-sponsoring organizations, Joan Claybrook of Public Citizen is coming over to speak.
Ronnie
so
Decker,
what this is the...
Don't you explain... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what we're looking for is the development of a broad coalition of organizations representing the people who turn on the Congress now and say, no more tinkering. The only thing that's going to stop this corruption is public funding.
Why don't you explain your own organization, Alliance for Democracy, that has often been described as a third party in this country?
Well, because, yes, it has been, but that is, of course, mistaken, as I think, Amy, you may remember from previous programs. The Alliance is not a party. It's an organization, a new organization, founded on populist principles from the actual populist movement of the last century, predicated on the conviction that major corporations and billionaires and very rich people now run the United States, that though we still have all the forms of democracy, what's permitted to pass through those forms into law is controlled by essentially a corporate oligarchy, that therefore the question for citizens who are committed to nonviolent and peaceful means of change is to challenge the whole system, that we can't go on asking for one reform after another when we get none of them. For 20 years has not been a fundamental reform passed in that Congress. That we have to raise the question, why isn't democracy economic too? Why isn't the question of justice a question of the distribution of wealth? Why is it all right for Bill Gates to have $78 billion when one out of four children in the country is in poverty? When our child poverty rate is higher than Western Europe or Japan by four times, why is that all right for Mr. Gates to have $78 billion, which would take, at a million a year, $78,000 to earn? So we're fundamentally an organization that has come together to introduce economic democracy into the formulation for what democracy should be. And that, of course, includes the distribution of wealth in a fairer and juster way.
You're listening to Ronnie Duggar, who is with Alliance for Democracy. We've also been speaking with Randy Keeler. And the flyer that we have for today's event says, Citizens Revolt to Stop Crimes Against Democracy. That is advertising both the major protests that's taking place today and also the civil disobedience that will take place soon after at about 2 o'clock in small print. And we're going to come back to them after the break to talk more about a growing grassroots movement in this country for private money to get out of public campaigns. The small print says, we've had it with campaign finance corruption. The big money manipulation of our legislature is a crime against democracy. The Senate's recent action was the filibuster that broke the people's back. Corporate and multimillionaire money denies 44 million of us health care, lets monopolists smash small businesses, permits polluters to foul our neighborhoods, opens up our natural resources to corporate exploitation, enables pork barrel spending, and renders the political process inaccessible to those who aren't wealthy enough to buy influence. It goes on to say federal campaigns are expected to receive $3 billion in the year 2000. Such legalized bribes will fundamentally undermine citizen priorities as America enters the next century. Finally, it says we're willing to pay to have our elections publicly funded, and we will no longer stand by as these crimes occur. Come help us stop them. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Ronnie Duggar, who is the founder of the Alliance for Democracy, and Randy Keeler, longtime war tax resister, co-founder of the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, and co-founder of the Working Group on Electoral Democracy. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are going to be participating in a major protest today outside and perhaps inside the Capitol in Washington, D.C. Citizens revolt to stop crimes against democracy, protesting the scuttling not only of the campaign finance bill last week, the McCain-Feingold bill, but in general, the whole issue of private money and public campaigns. Ronnie Duggar, founder of the Alliance for Democracy, is with us in the Washington studio, and Randy Keeler, longtime war tax resister and co-founder of the Working Group on Electoral Democracy. Randy Keeler, why is it that according to U.S. law, it's illegal for a U.S. corporation to give a foreign government money, but they can give current government officials money? They can pour money into U.S. campaigns. Randy, are you with us?
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you, Randy.
Yes. So you're referring to the non-U.S. corporations abroad.
Yeah.
And why they
well,
can
no,
give money
US,
to our...
U.S. corporations can't give money. You know, it's illegal for them to give money to foreign governments, but here they are in this country aligning the pockets of U.S. government
That's
officials.
Right. And I might add also that it's... illegal for foreign corporations and foreign governments to try to spend money to influence our elections, and yet it is commonplace and not even a matter of denial that our government pours money hand over fist into other people's elections in other countries to influence them so that they come out pro-U.S. So there's a huge double standard here, and obviously if you accept the premise, which I do and which the Alliance for Democracy does, that we have a government essentially run by large corporations, then naturally you wouldn't be surprised to find a double standard in favor of those corporations. So I don't know how else to explain it.
Randy Keeler, what brought your path to Washington today, to this protest? I know you as a person who lost your home because you refused to pay taxes because you don't want those taxes going to the Pentagon to pay for wars that you don't support, as a big activist against nuclear weapons. Now you're involved with the whole issue of campaign finance. What brought you here?
Well, Amy, in a way, it was the nuclear disarmament issue. And when I was working with the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, one of the things that became painfully, painfully obvious was that even when you have demonstrably, in documentable form, the majority of the American people and even state legislatures and city councils all over the country in favor of a public policy shift, as we did have in the case of the nuclear freeze, even then, we do not have a system of government that can respond democratically to that majoritarian sentiment. And when we worked the halls of Congress, when we did our lobbying, when we tried to translate this majoritarian sentiment into policy so that the U.S. would take the position of advocating a nuclear weapons freeze with the Soviet Union, we heard point blank from members of Congress, you know, what you haven't factored in here, you activists, you citizens, is that our campaigns are being paid for in part by the weapons makers. The very people who you would put out of business or forced to change their business are not going to let this happen. They finance our parties, our campaigns. And this just said to me, there's another battle here that has to be fought, and not only for nuclear disarmament, for clean air, clean water, for universal health care, for, you know, all the issues we care about, food safety, living wages, fair taxation. In every single one of those instances, millions and millions of dollars is being poured into the coffers, the campaign coffers of the very people we elect to be our public servants, to represent us in Washington. And, I mean, it's such an obvious problem, and yet one we have lived with, I'm afraid, for so many decades, in fact, from the beginning, the founding of this country, that people have learned to live with it. Even activists, even progressives, all sorts of good people assume that's the only way it can work. And so, I think you know, a number of us started out about 10 years ago, activists from civil rights issues, environmental issues, peace, justice issues, saying we have to change the political process itself to make it possible for people, for democracy to flourish, so that when there is a majoritarian sentiment, as there was for the freeze, big money doesn't stand in the way of a policy shift that the people want.
Do you think that's what happened, what we just saw last week, along with the campaign finance bill going down, the nuclear test ban treaty going down in the Senate? Do you think it's the same
route? I don't want to oversimplify. I think that, in fact, there are strong nationalistic and ideological factors involved here. It isn't simply a matter of campaign contributions. On the other hand, we all know that corporations produce these weapons. Corporations out-lobby the peace movement, the disarmament folks, by 10, 20, 100 to 1. And so the voice of the people on this issue really isn't even heard adequately. I wouldn't suggest that the policy would automatically shift if the big money were taken out of the equation, but I think it would have a chance. That's all we ask for, an even chance to debate the policies on their merits. And in this particular case, if I had to bet, I'd say we would have endorsed that treaty if the corporate money were out of the equation, even though there are other elements to that equation.
Ronnie Duggar, as we move into the year 2000, your Alliance for Democracy has been organizing for how long?
4 years now.
4 years.
4 years. We started in 1995.
Do you feel
55 chapters?
Do you feel a difference? I mean, do you feel that these kinds of issues? I mean, here you have the defeat of the most pathetic in campaign finance bills. It was so watered down by the time it was about to be voted on. Do you feel that there's going to be a change, some kind of watershed that will turn things around?
Of course, I don't know. None of us knows. You don't have to have optimism to have hope. We have hope, Amy. The reason I think we're here is that this is sort of the limit. What they've done is sort of the limit. Just before the millennium turns, they spurn public demand for which is 80 or 90% of the population wants campaign finance reform, and they turn their back on it. We feel that we Randy has been the moral leader. No question about the civil disobedience that will occur this afternoon in the Capitol. We are going to be reading more or less a conversation, my part of the rally and my part of the inside action, which will be participated in, too, by Chuck Collins, the executive director of United for a Fair Economy, of course acting as an individual, as I will be. We mean to say this to the Congress. If I may, Amy, read three paragraphs from a citizen's address to the Congress that we'll be giving both inside and outside the Capitol.
Feel free to read.
Permission to do that?
Feel free to read more. This isn't soundbite radio. Our listeners enjoy the whole meal.
We've lost our country. We want it back from the gigantic corporations. We want it back from the billionaires and the multimillionaires. We want it back from you, members of Congress. We want you to do our business, not theirs. You declaim and legislate against crime and criminals, but your crimes against democracy mock your eloquence and your righteousness. You dress appropriately, and we know you're kind to your own children and have many other good qualities. But if you are not working to end campaign corruption by enacting full public funding of all federal elections and the other needed reforms of the election system, your honor and your virtue are mocked by the crimes that you, you personally and you together, are committing against democracy. Here in the Capitol every day, the Congress in which you sit is committing and perpetuating capital crimes against democracy. Bribery, theft, despoliation, rape of the environment, criminal neglect of the young and the sick and the dying. Congress is selling, and Congress is killing, the ideal that has been cherished for centuries in Western civilization, democracy. The basic idea we're bringing to the Capitol is basically Randy Keeler's idea. Crimes are in progress in this Capitol, but it's the people's house, and the people have to come into that house and stop the crimes.
And one thing I might add to that, Amy, is that, you know, you're aware that there has been a growing citizen movement to essentially challenge privately financed elections and to replace them with publicly financed ones. And there is all kinds of good work going on around the country. In fact, Public Campaign, a group I often work with, is working with coalitions of citizen groups, environmental groups, women's groups, good government groups, labor groups, in over 30 states to enact full public financing. And there's all kinds of good public education going. There's research happening demonstrating what these crimes against democracy really amount to, how much money is going into the pockets of which politicians from which corporations, how much that's affecting ordinary people. But one missing element many of us feel in this growing movement is, in fact, nonviolent direct action, which, as you know, has been an essential component of every major historic movement that's led to any major shift in public policy or institutional behavior in this country over the years and decades and centuries. And so we feel that after years and years and years of groups going through all the proper channels, which they will continue to do, ballot initiatives to change laws at the state level, petitioning Congress, lobbying, and so forth, it is time for nonviolent direct action, including civil disobedience. We've seen it in the environmental movement. Of course, there's a long, honorable history in the labor movement, in the civil rights movement, in the gay liberation movement. There has never been, to our knowledge, nonviolent direct action, including civil disobedience, on behalf of campaign finance reform, on behalf of replacing this horribly corrupt campaign finance system we have now. And we want to break through that glass ceiling, if you will, with our action today. We're not expecting huge results. We don't expect the system to come crumbling down just because nine of us are prepared to risk arrest in the rotunda reading the address that Ronnie just shared with us. But we do hope that it's a beginning and that this will kick off similar actions in state capitals as well as the U.S. Capitol around the country, where citizens will say, as Ronnie just said, we've had enough. It's gone. We've tried everything else, and we will keep trying, but we are also going to be more forceful. We're going to express our outrage more directly. We're going to carry this protest directly to the halls of Congress, to the halls of the state houses, and we are going to charge those who are committing these crimes against democracy appropriately.
May I add, Amy, that
Ronnie Duggar.
This is just the Democracy Brigade. We want brigades. We want this to spread. We want people who are ready to stand up and risk arrest, if necessary, to join us. And I hope that you'll let me ask Randy to give his telephone number, because he's been the recruiter for the original brigade. And people who might want to join us in the second or third actions perhaps should call Randy. Is that all right for me to ask you
that? Sure.
Anyone who would like to find out more about this Democracy Brigade and future ones, please feel free to call me. The telephone is area code 413, number 624-3836. 413-624-3836.
And about the Alliance for Democracy, which we now have 55 chapters. We're going to form two more in upstate New York tomorrow and the next day. If anyone would like to have more information about the Alliance, please call 781-894-1179, which is our national office. Or if you prefer to email, it would be peoplesall, peoplesall@aol.com. We'd love to hear from you.
I want to ask about who else will be participating in the protest today, and that goes to the issue of politicians. Will you have any Congress members or senators with you, any state legislators?
We actually, 100% of those we've invited have decided to join us. We have invited Senator Paul Wellstone. And the reason we've done that is because he has been such a stellar advocate for us on behalf of all of those who want full public financing. And in fact, little known, I think, outside of the halls of Congress, Senator Wellstone from Minnesota actually introduced an amendment to the McCain-Feingold bill during this last debate, an amendment that called for Congress to permit state legislatures to enact voluntary systems of full public financing for the elections of members of Congress from those states. And, of course, the amendment did not pass. But this is the kind of thing that you can really count on Senator Wellstone to do, and he has done it over and over again on this issue. So he has agreed to speak, and he will be the only member of Congress speaking.
And he's the only person we asked, although we gave thought to, for example, asking Senator McCain and Senator Feingold. But we wanted we didn't want to have too many of the insiders, even those exemplary guys on this issue, there, because this is really a citizen address. We're really going forward as some of the citizens, hoping to represent more and more of the citizens in exactly what we're saying, that the only way to fix the system is with full public financing. By the way, on that question, you know, the standard attack of full public financing, Amy, you must have heard it many times, is that, well, you're just giving money to politicians. The fact of the matter is we're funding our own elections at a cost of maybe $10 more or less a year.
Per person,
For our own education. These people are coming forward to us and saying they want to lead us. Well, we should pay for the forums which they participate in discussing public policy in our interests. Because, of course, when the forums are paid for as they are now by the corporate interests, that's what they represent.
Explain further what you mean by that. I mean, we know what the argument is, as you pointed out, and the other side is, why should the public be forced to pay for these candidates coming forward? Let them raise their own money. If they're popular enough, they'll raise the money. But what's your response to that?
Well, I would say that the apogee of that position is Mr. Forbes' position, whom I heard say on C-SPAN two nights ago that there should be no limits on campaign contributions, none at all. That is to say, let the billionaires buy the elections, and indeed let the billionaires be the presidents. The other position is that we ourselves are, these are our elections. They belong to us, the people. They do not belong to those damn politicians. Those politicians are going to have to educate us and themselves and each other, and we're going to pay for the microphones they use. Do you remember when Ronald Reagan turned to George Bush in 1980 and said, I paid for that microphone, Mr. Bush? Well, the people should be able to turn to the candidates and say, I paid for that microphone, Senator.
And, of course, there's the ACLU's position, is that limiting the flow of money is limiting free speech.
Well, actually, that has been the ACLU's position. And yet, interestingly enough, just in today's Washington Post and also today's New York Times, I don't know if you've had a chance to see either of them today, Amy, but there is a quarter-page ad, which is an essay jointly written by the ACLU and Public Campaign, that was worked out over the last few months by Ellen Miller, head of the Public Campaign, and Ira Glasser, head of the ACLU. And in it, both organizations say, we need to change the subject about campaign finance reform, that the two approaches that have been debated in Congress ad nauseum, one being that we'll somehow tinker with the private system through more and more limits, and the other being that we'll just get rid of all limits, as Forbes has
real
said.
Quick.
These are dead-end approaches, and the only way it's going to work is full public financing of elections, and the ACLU now endorses that position, as does Public Campaign. Hmm.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Ronnie Duggar and Randy Killer will both be participating in the protest that's taking place outside the Capitol and inside the Capitol today at noon and at 2 o'clock, part of a citizens' revolt to stop crimes against democracy. Their numbers again, the Alliance for Democracy, 781-894-1179, and the Democracy Brigade's 413-624-3836. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. I have a